One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai. Kosai.org.
There again, friends, and thanks for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. I'm Cam Hale, as always, in studio with me, es mi long time amigo, Mr. Filio Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I hope everybody had a good Easter. Yes. Cam, did you have a good Easter?
Of course. Look, dude, I got to cut back on the chocolate, man. You ever have so much you get jittery? I started getting jittery.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, because I'm a chocolate
junkie.
You're
a big Cadbury egg guy, aren't you?
Cadbury, not the cream eggs. I don't like that crap, but I like the caramel.
I got you.
What do you say? Is it caramel or caramel?
I think it depends on where you're from.
I just think it's both. It's magical. Like the Ferrero Rocher. Isn't that the other stuff?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I heard that the chocolate inside those is made by the Nutella company. The same people that made those makes Nutella. I don't know if that's true, but I really like that Nutella too. But look, I got to cut way back on that because I can really lose it. Like I'm not really hooked on a whole lot of stuff. Till it comes to chocolate. I got it bad, man. So,
you know, when they talk about the pronunciation of different words, we make fun of that all the time. Like, I don't know. And it does seem to be regional, but I want to know, like, we were settled by England. So we speak English. So why do we spell things different than they do? Like tires, they spell T-Y-R-E-S and we spell it T-I-R-E-S.
English language is a joke.
I know,
because
right?
There's certain things and one word can mean four different things. I'm not even going to get into that at all. But what I am going to get into, folks, is some cool news stories.
Yeah, let's do this.
Now, I got one that's not so cool. For those of you that are big fans of Roswell, New Mexico and the Roswell crash, I don't know if you saw this. Now, there's a good article here I'm going to talk to you about. It comes from Open Minds. According to police, the Roswell Museum UFO that was stuck in the side of the building there has been destroyed by vandals. Now, this
get
was
a
posted.
Life.
Yeah, this was posted on the 24th of March. It says a large disc-shaped UFO, the one, was stolen from the International UFO Museum and Research Center there in Roswell on Saturday morning. Now, it says after missing for several days, it was then found broken into pieces in a ditch on the side of Highway 2. I'm sorry, on the side of the highway 2 miles outside of town. It says although the theft was caught on a surveillance camera, the perpetrators of the crime are still at large. Now, the large UFO is usually mounted on the corner of the building, housing, of course, the museum.
Right.
They say, now, however, it's being stored in the back when it was taken. So I guess they'd headed off. Said it had fallen from the building, of course, during the winter storm. They just hadn't put it back up. They were going to remount it. Now, on March 21st, the Roswell Police Department posted the news of the theft of the UFO on their Facebook page. And they reported that the UFO had been stolen just before 3:30 a.m. on Saturday, March 19th. And then, of course, they went on and they promoted that. They said they had found the next day that they had found pieces of it off of Highway 70 outside of town. So the sad thing is they actually have, they've posted some security footage. And you can go to the Roswell Police Department RPD Facebook page, and you can watch the video. It's got the guys. You can tell they're trying to load it, looks like, into a pickup, and then they found it. Now, Karen, the museum's interim executive director, Yarmilo, says that it's a historical piece of our building.
Yeah, man.
It was just fiberglass and a stainless steel bowl wrapped with rope lights that's changed colors, of course, at night. Now, that's what she said. That's all it was. But it said it's sad that it's not with us anymore. We hope that it's returned. So I guess they're hoping to get it rebuilt, things like that. My thing is this. I can understand why somebody would want to be like an overzealous fan and would sneak up there and steal something like that. I'm not saying it's right, but I can understand people getting carried away wanting to do that. But why would you destroy it?
Right, just to take it down, just to destroy it?
Just to destroy it. Why? I mean, unless they owed you money and you wanted to hold it hostage. But why would you just steal something simply for the fact of destroying it when it may not mean anything to you, but it means something to the people that own it? It'd be like me coming over to your house and stealing a potted plant and tearing it up just because.
But it's even more than that, because it's an iconic thing. People have been taking selfies there since, yes, you know, the museum was built.
Well, what I want to know is this. Do you think that they were afraid they were going to get caught with it? They knew if they were just going to see it, they just tried to destroy it to get away from it?
Maybe.
Because my thing is this. Why didn't you just drop it off on the side of the road, complete, and just leave? You know what I mean?
Yeah, because these people are jerks. That's why.
Because, they're idiots and they're thieves, and I got no use for them. But anyway, folks, it's a pretty sad deal. So you know what? Maybe let's keep our eyes open. Maybe there's going to be a little GoFundMe or something. Let's, you know, throw some money. Everybody throw $5 at them, $2 at them, $1. Let's get them a little money. Let's let them, somebody build them another one. Let's stick it up there. Let's make one nicer.
Have you ever been to Roswell? Maybe the winter storm.
I've been through Roswell numerous times, and I've never stopped there.
That's me. I've never stopped at the museum or anything, but I've driven through there.
Let's make a trip.
I know, right? And every time I drive through or near Roswell, lots of times it's been dark out when I was making the drive. I catch myself constantly looking
all
around.
The time.
I don't know why. I think because it happened there that it's going to happen again. Yeah, I look outside all the time.
Well, I had heard that they had lost a bunch of the city signs. People steal those.
I can understand the reason
stealing those over this UFO. So let's make a trip. We're going to have to plan a trip. We may hit up a bunch of listeners, everybody that's anywhere. We'll all just have to just descend on Roswell one day just for fun.
That sounds really cool. Well, sticking with the UFO idea, do you know who Aaron Rodgers is?
Yeah. Green Bay.
The Green Bay Packers. Well, if you're not an American, you don't follow American football. He's the quarterback of the Green Bay Packers, a football team. And he actually had a UFO sighting of his own. And this comes to us from CBS Sports. Now, he says, "We were winding down after dinner, and there was a weird siren in the distance. So we decided to go outside. Now, it was a snowy night, and when we went outside, it was one of those bright nights where it's kind of overcast, but there's enough light from the moon to see things. And the next thing you know, we saw something in the sky. It was a large, orange, left-to-right moving object. Now, because of the overcast nature of the night and the snow, you couldn't make it out. It was behind the clouds when we were seeing it. But it was definitely large and in the night sky, moving from left to right. Again, it was like 12:30 at night. It was me, Steve, and my brother who all saw it. So that means all three of us saw it." He said, "And then it went out of sight. And we all looked at each other and was like, what the hell was that?" He said, "You could hear it moving. And when it had been out of sight for like 30 seconds, well, he says 30 seconds, but it felt like it was 5 minutes. We were all kind of in shock. And then he goes on to say that shortly after that, they heard a group of about 4 fighter jets overhead, and they knew what the fighter jets were because, you know, they were familiar with what they look like and by the sounds. So that's an interesting story. And it reminds me of like the Stephenville case where they saw this object and then moments later, fighter jets are scrambled, right?
Yeah.
Seems like something more than just somebody out flying a drone or testing some top secret thing. It almost sounds like these fighter jets were on an intercept mission, if that makes any sense.
It does sound a lot like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, pretty cool. I love it when famous people come forward with the sighting, you know? I don't know why. It just seems more credible.
Well, and he's not calling it like an alien spacecraft. Simply, and that's where people, I think, get a little messed up. When people start saying, anybody says, "Well, I saw a UFO," instantly they're like, "Oh, you saw a flying saucer with green men." You're like, No. There's something in the sky flying. It's unidentified to me, which pretty much everything in the sky is unidentified to me because I'm an idiot.
I think it is to most people.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, like, I know what a hot air balloon looks like during the daytime, and I know what a plane and a helicopter looks like. That's it. Now, if you start asking me, like, you can tell the difference between a lot of jets because you've always enjoyed it since a child.
I love aviation, yeah.
I can't. I can go, yeah, that's a jet. or it's got a prop. That's about as far as I get into it.
I had a neighbor one time that was convinced that he was seeing UFOs all the time during the daytime. He'd say, man, I see them all the time. And I was like, really? He's like, yeah, dude, I don't know what they are, but I see them. And they move funny and stuff like that. I was like, okay, well, the next time you think you see one, let me know, would you? So, you know, a couple months goes by. I happen to be outside mowing my yard. He comes, Kyle, come here. I see one right now. I was like, okay. He pointed at me. You know what it was?
What?
It was sunlight reflecting off of like an airliner. I'm like, you realize that's a plane, right? That's a jet. No, it just looks like a white glowing orb. I'm like, that's the sun's reflection.
Oh, wow.
So, look, he was a good guy.
Misidentification.
Misidentification. So I wonder how many times people see things like that, and you're like,
we've discussed it about people seeing it in the woods.
Yeah, you don't know what it is. I heard there was a big case of, you know, like the big Zeppelins that follow these golf tournaments around. Mm-hmm. There were people, there was one at night. It was the day before the golf tournament was actually supposed to start, so they had to inflate it, I guess, at like Alliance Airport. Then fly to the Colonial or something.
It's not super fast.
And well, in the night, though, there was several cases of people calling in saying they were seeing a UFO. And they were like, no, that's like the MetLife blimp, buddy.
But I bet at night that thing does look intimidating as hell.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, it's pretty cool.
Well, I got you something. We always laugh and we talk about people, you know, the DIY stuff. We love the DIY stuff. And then also using modern technology along with that. Well, get a load of this from Science Alert. There's a young man that 3D printed his own braces for less than $60. Now, get a load of this.
That's brilliant.
Says a digital design student in New Jersey went viral over the weekend after 3D printing his very own set of clear orthodontic aligners, just like the ones that you go and you buy. And it says for thousands of dollars, and it cost him less than $60. Amos Dudley, 23-year-old young man, had braces as a child. But, like a lot of people, quits wearing the aligners.
Right.
Everything goes south again. And he couldn't afford to have his dental work redone. He's a college student, you know. He's trying to get through school. So, what he says, he did have access to a digital fabrication tools in the university there. So, he's like, hey, let's see what we can do. So, what's he do? So, he goes. He said he was inspired, of course, after researching some brand name aligners. He noticed, he scrolled in, zoomed up on the picture, that they were 3D printed layer striations in the plastic. So he's like, oh, wait a minute. I think I know what they're doing here, because he had seen them in their own stuff that they had built. So he says, and he wrote on a blog, he says, what it is to stop someone who has access to a 3D printer from making their own orthodontic aligners. He says, turns out not much. He says, after doing a lot of research into the proper orthodontic process, he started by taking a mold of his teeth using alginate powder. He filled it with liquid permastone to set them. Then he just goes in and he scans it into the software that they use to make the digital progression prints of his teeth. And then what he did was, this is where it gets wild. He goes into an animation. Now, it's not like somebody at home would just have all this stuff, so you kind of got to go through that. But he said what he did was he measured the total distance of travel for the basically animated his teeth of where the total distance would travel of where he wanted them to be lined up in this computer program, divided it by the maximum recommended distance of tooth travel per aligner. And then he just went through and broke them down into sections and then started printing out his aligners. He talks about all the stuff that he uses. He's already had them out for 16 weeks, had them, you know, wearing them for 16 weeks. Says he only takes them out to eat. He says, as far as I know, I'm the only person to have tried DIYing plastic aligners. They're much more comfortable than braces and fit my teeth quite well. I was pleased to find that when I put the first one on, they only seemed to put very little noticeable pressure on my teeth that I had planned to move. So he said it was a success. Man. He says he feels like he can freely smile again. And I tell you what, he's got some progressions of the whole deal, but it is a really, really neat thing. But I never thought about that. Now you think of this. How much longer till it's one of those things where at home, let's say they have an app. You know, there's always, we laugh about it. There's an app for that. Well, let's say there's a dental app. And for $150, you get the program that you upload your scan into. So you already have a digital printer, right?
Yeah.
They send you the kit, how to cast your teeth. You cast your teeth, you scan it in. It goes into this program. It does all the figuring for you. And then every few weeks it's programmed. When your new one prints out, that's the one that you put on.
You don't even need to do that. You could just go on like Fiverr and have somebody else who already owns the software to do it for you.
Exactly.
I mean, I need to get this kid's contact information because Caleb's fixing to need braces.
There you go.
And I can give this kid, heck, I'll give him $100.
Right? There you go.
A couple thousand.
That's the whole thing. So, yet again, just one guy think outside the box because he saw the striations in it. And he's like, man, I think I can do that.
He can.
And he did.
Well, that's all they're doing. They're doing the same thing he is, but they're just charging a premium price for it.
But not everybody, of course, has the
No, I'm talking about the dental lab, though, that makes the braces and these aligners.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing.
It's just funny. Oh, that's exactly what they do. But he just doesn't, you know, not everybody's got the access to that. But it may one day, just like cell phones, not everybody had the access to calculators. Now they're everywhere. So
pretty cool. Did you see this over on Cryptozoology News? Recently, a 44-year-old Toowoomba resident and a known radio personality who provided a full name and contact information but was asked to keep it anonymous told Cryptozoology News that on Wednesday he saw an unusual animal while on his way to town on March 9th. He said, "I was driving from Highfields to Toowoomba, and it was 3 to 3:30 a.m. The driver explained that the sighting only lasted a few seconds, but he was able to see what looked like an animal that was a combination of a dingo and a fox."
What?
Yeah. He says, "It ran in front of my car. It had a fox head, tall dog-like body, and like a greyhound or a fox's tail." He says, "There have been other sightings in that area, and eyewitnesses are referring to it as a fingo, a mix between a dingo and a fox." Now, when you hear the story, you're like, okay, so maybe that's exactly what that is.
Yeah.
But there's several biologists that are claiming that that's not possible. They say that like canid hybrids often take place in the wild between like domestic or feral dogs. Mm-hmm. But dogs such as like dingoes, gray wolves, and other things like that, they don't believe that they can reproduce with each other, because even if they did, the next animal would be infertile, like a mule or something. Yes. The only animals that they know of in that area that can do that is a black-jacked jackal or a side-striped jackal that has able to interbreed and produce fertile offspring. So the question is, I know what he's claiming to be what he saw, but it's not possible. There's no way a dingo and a fox can mix.
Well, what they're saying, though,
is... So what leads to that? You know, what is it?
Well, what that article's saying, though, is that there's no way that if they mixed, that it wouldn't be fertile. That doesn't mean it wouldn't be alive.
Well, you're right.
What that one's running around may be sterile, but it could be there.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it sounds like. So... either he saw a dog that has like the mange or something we talked about.
Or just a different color pattern.
Or a different color pattern. Or, like you're saying, it is actually a fingo.
Well, you can see different color patterns in coyotes across the state of Texas.
You sure can.
From east to west, north to south, they're all different. It's almost like it's natural camouflage for them, the same as whitetail, the same as most animals, of course, aside from hogs. But you're going to see them that you can almost blend into their surroundings better. So maybe it was just one that had a little bit different color pattern, or maybe it really was a crossbreed. Who knows?
Yeah, very, very interesting. Well, speaking of cryptozoology and cryptids, after the break, we're going to get into some unusual dogman sightings and actually the history of dogman sightings. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
All right, guys, let's do what Kyle was discussing. Let's jump into this. Like we said, we've covered Dogman. We've talked about some cool Dogman sightings. We've interviewed Linda Godfrey. Mm-hmm. We've talked to a few guys about that actually had an encounter with Dogman. But there's more to it than that. There's a lot more that goes into the history that, look, you can read into it that whether it be, I guess you could say, different tribes of people that may have wore wolf skins, things like that. You don't really know. But there's a lot more that goes into it besides just the lycanthropy and things like that. There's a lot more into this. We're going to kind of touch on that. Now, to bring everybody up to speed real quick, for those of you that don't know the real quick history of dog man, or maybe even, you know, if you're sick and tired of that, I'm sorry, but basically what we can find is, or what we know is, that the Michigan dog man is kind of where this first report kicked off from. It came from Wexford County, Michigan, back in 1887. Then you jump forward to 1987. There was a disc jockey radio host named Steve Cook, and he had actually talked about a sighting and played some music, I believe, with it, stuff like that. Then you jump into what really seemed to get the ball rolling with the fame is The Beast of Bray Road, which Linda Godfrey wrote the book in 2003 about that, which is a great book if you're really into dog men and all that. But like we say, there's some history that goes along with that. Some of this history comes all the way back from a tribe in Africa and a tribe in India. Now, they have a strange name, and this tribe is Cynocephali. And basically what they're saying is it's dog-headed men. And there's another one, too, that you can call Cynocephalos, and it means dog-headed, from Kuan. And then, of course, Cephalos is head. So dog-head is what this comes from. They talk that on these mountains there live men with the head of dogs, whose clothing is the skin of wild beasts. They speak no language but bark like dogs, and in this manner make themselves understood by each other. Their teeth are larger than those of dogs, their nails like those of these animals, but longer and rounder. They inhabit the mountains as far as the river Indus. Their complexion is swarthy. They are extremely just, like the rest of the Indians with whom they associate. They understand the Indian language, but are unable to converse, only barking or making signs with their hands and fingers by way of reply, like the deaf and dumb. They're also called Kalstril in Greek, which means dog-headed. Now, that's another little part of it. There's a whole big thing, like I said, these different names that you can kind of get the linguist links to. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, even in like ancient Egypt, Anubis.
Yes.
There's pictures of a man body yes. with a dog or jackal's head.
Well, it says that this tribe that they're talking about would live on raw meat. Now, this is one account, that this tribe lived on raw meat and that they numbered around 120,000 of them.
Really?
That's what they're saying. Now, they're talking about that living on the mountains, they didn't practice any trade, but they lived by hunting. And that when they killed an animal, they just roasted it in the sun, just left it out, I guess, to dry is what they're trying to say, maybe. I don't know.
Like dry-aged meat. They're waiting for it to become more tender.
I guess that's what they're kind of what. They also say that they raised a number of goats and sheep, and that they would drink the milk of the sheep, and then, you know, I guess would make the cheese, whatever else. But they would eat fruit. And then they would have amber, and they would, you know, make other things there with the whole thing, that they would keep baskets of dried grapes that the Greeks would bring them also.
I gotcha.
Which is pretty wild. Now, they also said that they would make rafts, which they would load all this fruit together, and well-cleaned, says purple flowers, and I guess that they would exchange that down when they would come down off. But they were talking about they really don't do trade. They would just have it there. They just... I don't know. It's really, really weird. But that they said the Indians would bring, I guess, bread and flour and stuff for some of these things. But they said that they would buy swords for hunting wild beasts, bows and arrows, and that they were very, very skillful with bows and with spears. And there's a story that says that they cannot be defeated in war since they inhabit lofty and inaccessible mountains. And every 5 years, the king would send a present of 300,000 bows and many spears, 120,000 shields, and 50,000 swords to these people.
Really? That doesn't sound good. You're arming your neighbor.
But unless they were there strictly for, and this is what it made me think of. Could it have been a group that these were their warriors and that that's who they cut out? This is a warrior group. We will feed you. We will do all the trade for you. You just train to be our standing army. And then if we need protection, that's what you're here for. That we do all this where all you have to do is just live the life of said luxury at the time. We'll give you all the weapons. You're here to be like my security force.
So where does the story of the dog-headed people come from?
That's
you know what I mean? Yes. This just sounds like a group of people to me. It doesn't
well,
sound...
Well, that's the same people. What I'm talking about is the same dog-headed people. Why do they have the dog head? They can't speak. They can bark. They do hands. What they're talking about is they don't... They said they had long, round nails, but that they had hands. They didn't have paws. They had hands. So it's people with dog heads.
Oh, I see. See, I thought it was like a metaphor. Like it sounds like your language sounds like a dog barking.
Yeah.
So I'm going to represent you by drawing you with a dog's head. But they're claiming that this is really happening.
They're claiming that this is a real, like a dog-faced creature is what they're talking about.
Wow.
But it could be a metaphor, like what you're saying.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, one of the cases, you know, back in France, they had their thing called the France Werewolf Trials, which is much like the Salem Witch Trials here in the U.S., but this took place mostly in the early 1500s. There were several cases. One was a guy named Pierre Burgo. He was convicted for the mutilation and murder of a young boy and a woman and a four-year-old girl. He was charged with being a werewolf, and they killed him.
I remember reading some stuff. That was pretty disturbing, the things that he was doing.
And there was another guy by the name of Peter Stube, and this actually took place in Germany in a village called Bedburg back in 1589. And for years, the local townsfolk had been tormented by something they could only describe as a demon. Now check this out. It says their livestock and even children had become the victims of something horrible. Throats were ripped out and flesh was eaten away from the unfortunate victims. The beast that lingered in the forest had left a trail of blood and misery in its wake. Witnesses reported a wolf-like beast as being responsible for the grisly attacks. And villagers were afraid to travel and even neglected necessary chores in the fear of this mysterious creature. It wasn't long until, of course, a hunting party was organized in an attempt to kill the lycan beast. One night, in 1589, a group of hunters cornered what they could only describe as a hairy wolf-like animal. After attempts to stab it with spears, the dogs were released upon it. And something strange happened. The creature stood up. Suddenly, the hunters realized that the beast was none other than Peter Stube, a local citizen. Now, Stube was immediately arrested and put on trial, which what followed revealed the grotesque accounts that ended with the execution of Stube on Halloween night, 1589. It was learned in the trial that Stube had been responsible for the deaths of women, men, and children. He was charged with rape, murder, cannibalism, and he even confessed to eating the brains of his own son. Now, Stube confessed to practicing sorcery and witchcraft since the age of 12. Now, he claimed that he had indeed made a pact with the devil and was given the powers of the wolf. He admitted to stalking and devouring livestock in the area for many years. He confessed that Satan had given him a magic belt that when he put it on, caused his transformation into a wolf. He described how he would chase down young girls who had been in the fields like a swift hound, and upon catching the slowest one, he would devour their flesh. Stube was accused of much more unspeakable crimes and was eventually given one of the most brutal and grisly punishments in history. Most of the information about the incident has only been available because of an ancient pamphlet that describes the crimes and the trial. But it was written that the werewolf of Bedburg had had his skin torn from his body. His arms and legs were broken, and his head was severed. He was eventually burned to ash, but only after a monument was built as a warning to any others that may walk in the shadow of the wolf. Now, the people and the villagers there seemed convinced enough to dub Peter Stube the werewolf of Bedburg and forever place him in the history as a real wolfman. Now, of course, we've talked about this before. People are saying that this real case of this man going crazy and eating all these people and stuff and claiming that Satan had given him this special belt to transform himself into a wolf, just like all myths. Is that really true? I mean, I'm not doubting that he might have said that. But could he have been a crazy person?
I think he's just making a crazy person.
Crazy claims saying, oh, yeah, I made a pact with the devil, and that if I put this special belt on, I transform into a wolf. Because no one had claimed that they saw him transform into a wolf. I mean, the hunting party that cornered that what they thought was a wolf turned out to be Peter. But you got to look into that story really close. I mean, they didn't claim that they saw him transform into a man. They said he had a beast cornered. And when they put the dogs to him, it stood up and it was that guy, Peter.
Yeah. And he could have been wearing a skin, and he could have been
Wearing a ghillie suit.
He's a crazy person.
Been wearing, like you're saying, wolf-like a jacket made of wolf pelts and stuff.
Yeah, it's a crazy person.
That's what I think. I think that's what it is. But, you know, that's where a lot of these stories come from. But there's a lot of other stories that, you know, people see these strange things. And much like Sasquatch sightings, people claim that they saw it and that it was a dog. It was an upright walking animal. I mean, Linda Godfrey, you know, talked about it. The men we had on the show that had it, and they shot the thing. They didn't hurt it. We've had numerous other people email us privately their own stories. I mean, I remember one with a little girl we read one time, her and her mom. They saw it in the yard.
Yes.
So, man, I don't know. I love the stories.
Well, I got you another one we were talking about. This is a lot older. This is a 4th century BC from Tithius. This is a Greek historian, and it goes back into what we were talking about, these people again. Is this isn't so much the crazy people, maybe, as they're dealing with someone that's a group. Instead of one, it's a large group. And he writes that they do not live in houses, but in caves. They set out for the chase with bows and spears. There it is again. And as they are very swift of foot, they pursue and soon overtake their quarry. The women have a bath once a month. The men do not bathe at all, but only wash their hands. They anoint themselves 3 times a month with oil made from milk and wipe themselves with skins. Says the clothes of men and women alike are not skins with the hair on, but skins tanned and very fine. The richest wear linen clothes, but they are few in number. They have no beds, but sleep on leaves or grass. He who possesses the greatest number of sheep is considered the richest, and so in regard to their other possessions. Now all, both men and women, have tails above their hips like dogs, but longer and more hairy. They are just and live longer than any other men, 170, sometimes 200 years. Now how do you mistake that? What is that?
Yeah, a village of these people. I think it's their garments. I think it's their garments, people. And they're mistaking them for being dogs like tails.
Simply said, well, there's another one from the 2nd AD. There's a Greek natural history named Alanian. And he actually writes that in the same part of India as the crimson dye beetles are born, the Cynopholia, as they are called, a name which they owe their physical appearance in nature. He talks about this. And he says that they're in human shape, in the skins of beasts. They're upright. They injure no man, but they have no speech. They howl, but they understand the Indian language. And of course, it goes on and talks about what they eat, the wild animals. It says when they have caught them, they kill and cook them, not over a fire, but by exposing them to the sun's heat after they've shredded them into pieces. Sounds like dried meat. He talks again about the fact that they're inarticulate. They can't speak. They just communicate with the grunts. But that does sound like a tribe of people that doesn't speak their language. Maybe they've learned it, but
right.
They
so
don't speak
They think it.
It
sounds like a dog yipping, but it's not. It's a different dialect. I'm picturing like the 13th Warrior.
Exactly.
Remember where those guys dressed up as bears and they're attacking that village. And I'm trying to think of his name. Bolvi has to come and help out this king. And it isn't until after their like first battle that they all kind of look at each other and they say, you know what? They're not bears. They're men.
These are just men.
This whole time, up until this point, the village thought they were being attacked by these bears, and they didn't realize it. Maybe this tribe is a primitive tribe that they've come across that in a similar fashion, they're instead of wearing bear pelts, they're wearing wolf pelts, and they have an unnatural language they never heard. It's not really a dog's tail. They thought it looked like the people had dog tails. They're eating raw meat, so they just say, oh, yeah, those people are like werewolves. They're like half dog, half people. I could see how that it'd be, you know, that could happen. Also, I want to say this is from Greek legends, right?
Yes.
Well, you got to remember the Greeks are also people that believe in, you know, Poseidon lives under the ocean and all these other, you know, gods. So for them to think of half human, half dogs, I mean, doesn't seem like a stretch to me. I mean, you're talking about people that think about Zeus and Ares and stuff.
The minute I started reading and researching this and talking about how there's some more writing that says that their whole body's covered in hair. Another respect they say, which makes them resemble dogs. They're very fast, you know, fleet of foot, it says.
Yep.
It says that they live by hunting gazelle and antelope. But listen to this. It says further that they are black in appearance and they have the head and teeth of a dog. Well, the more I got to thinking about this, could this be lost tribes of primitive people that are the last, say, remaining people after a great cataclysm? That they've lost their spoken language. They've lost their ability. They're small pockets of people. Now, they did say there was 120,000. Maybe that wasn't true.
Right. Yeah.
But what if? What if this is like when you stumble, you know, these Greeks are there, they feel like they're the most advanced, much like we do. And then we find maybe, you know, these remote groups of people, except then that's how they were relating it, is they were like, these are dog people. Maybe they do. Who knows? But that's how they've learned, is they don't have, they've lost the ability to maybe even build fire. So that's the reason they have to use the sun to dry it. Maybe it's really not. Now, I know we've twisted away folks from the upright canids, but that's where this history ties in, is maybe it's not real werewolves, real dog men in these older stories, that we're trying to link more together with that than what we think. There's a little bit of writing, it says, and it says here that, and it will drink wine, and if boiled or cooked meat is served to it, it will eat its fill. And it likes well-seasoned food, but food boiled without any care, it dislikes. If it wears clothes, it is careful of them. And it does everything else that I have described. But if you put it, while still tiny, to a woman's breast, it will suck the milk like a baby. Well, then, couldn't it just be a person that's raised very primitive?
That's what I think. I think that's exactly what it's
Why
describing.
Does it like well-seasoned food? Because it's never had it.
Never had it.
And you taste it, and you love it. Now, here's something interesting. There was an English knight who traveled all through the Holy Land, through China, through India, through Egypt. His name was Sir John Mandeville. And he had claimed, even in this book that he had written, he had claimed that he had served in the Khan's army and all this stuff. And he actually wrote this in his little book. It says, men go by the sea ocean, by many isles, unto an isle that is called Nakamera, that is a good isle and fair. And it is in compass about more than 1,000 miles. And all the men and women of that isle have hound's heads. And they be called Cynocephalids. Are dog heads, and they be full responsible and of good understanding, save that they worship an ox for their god. And also every one of them beareth an ox of gold or of silver on his forehead, in token that they love well their god. And they all go naked, save a little clout. They be great folk and well fighting, and they have had a great large shield that covereth the whole body, and a spear in their hand to fight with. And if they take any man to battle, anon they eat him. So it sounds like a group of people. First of all, when they start talking about the ox, makes me think of the bull.
Mm-hmm.
The study, the worship of the bull.
Yeah.
You look into this.
Ball.
You start looking, you're like, these more sound more like a primitive warring culture that maybe just kind of slipped out of a group.
I mean, a werewolf that makes a shield and spear and armor and stuff.
Werewolves don't need it.
Nah.
In Marco Polo's travels, he's even written that he mentions that there is an island, the Andaman Islands, and he actually says that these people grow spices, but they are nonetheless cruel, and they're all just like big mastiff dogs.
Big mastiffs?
Yes. Even the Buddhist missionaries in China even talk about an island of dog-headed men in East Fusang. And that they say that there's a part where they mention it, that it's called in their history the Dog Kingdom. But that could mean a lot of different things. So you get these strange accounts of all these people that talk about how they dress. If you notice, though, they never say they're all built just exactly like dogs. They have a dog face. Well, what could that mean? Could it mean hairy? A beard? I have a beard. Is it woolly like a dog? Is it a dog's face? I mean, I know I got a dog's face, but I mean, I got like a pug face, all smashed up, fat, but like a bulldog face. But is it that? Is it the hair? Is it the tan?
That's what I'm saying. I'm imagining.
What is it?
You groom yours, but imagine if you lived outdoors and you didn't have the ability. And your hair was long, not just on the top of your head,
yes,
but everywhere. And you were dirty, and you had, you know, leaves and stuff in your hair, and you had a different type of dress. You might look more like a dog. I don't
you
know.
Might. Yeah,
I think they're just trying to describe whatever it is that they saw.
Yeah, I'm with you, because it doesn't sound like. And folks, we're going to get to some stories on dog men. But this is where the history gets in. It doesn't seem to go. I guess the reason we're doing this is because it doesn't seem to go hand in hand with the dog men stories that we get with the sightings now.
Yes.
What we learn now, what we see now, isn't like a tribe of people. It isn't like a misidentification. The things we find now are more dog-like.
Yes. I mean, I've read stories where people talk about it looked like something from the movie The Howling.
Mm-hmm.
So, is it a condition where these stories of dog-headed people or dog men from these ancient stories has collectively been in everybody's storytelling,
And now, because of the introduction of television and movies, our thought processes have actually created these tulpas, which look like the modern day werewolves. Is that what they're coming? These have been created by through thought processes. Is that what we're experiencing? Have you ever heard of the Morbach werewolf?
I don't think so.
This is a pretty interesting story. Now, according to legend, the Rhineland town of Wittlich is said to be the last place in Germany where a werewolf was killed. Now, a man named Thomas Johannes Baptist Schweitzer was a supposed deserter from Napoleon's army and a veteran of the disaster at Moscow. He was fleeing to his homeland in France, and with him are a group of Russians who were also deserters. Now, while passing by the village of Wittlich, the hungry soldiers spotted a farmhouse, and they decided to take whatever they wanted. In the midst of their scavenging, they were discovered by the farmer, who they promptly murdered along with his sons. Now, the farmer's wife, witnessing this terrible deed, let out a wail and decided to curse Schweitzer. She said in her curse, "From now on, at each full moon, you will change into a rabid wolf." Now, Schweitzer, hearing her say this, crushed in her skull and disposed of the body. Now, as time goes on, the curse started to take hold. Gradually, a change came over Schweitzer. His personality became harder and without inhibitions. He began robbing, he began raping, and he began murdering at his pleasure. He soon departs with his fellows, who have had enough of him by this time, and he took up with some bandits and some other highwaymen. Now, the ruffians were appalled at Schweitzer's excesses, so the ex-soldier flees to the sanctuary of the deep forests. There, the tales of a wolf that walks like a man spread throughout the countryside. At night, men and cattle are brutally slaughtered by the beast. And one night, Schweitzer observes the beautiful daughter of a local farmer. Her name was Elizabeth Barriel, and in his carnal lust, he rapes her. Days later, while by his campfire in the woods, Schweitzer is discovered by a group of villagers who take him for a werewolf. They give chase and corner the fugitive near the village of Morbach. Now, promptly dispatching Schweitzer, the villagers bury him at a crossing, and there's a shrine erected where a candle will burn continually. As long as the candle is lit, so the legend goes, the werewolf will not return. 9 months later, a son is born to Elizabeth, whom she names Martin. And to this day, descendants of this child are a respected family in the vicinity of Morbach. And to show no sign of the curse of their infamous ancestor. Now, that's where the story ends. Or at least that's what most people thought. That is until 1988. And that's where the story picks up. Check this out. One evening, a group of Air Force personnel were returning to their base at Morbach. Passing the old shrine, they noticed that the candle was out. They began to laugh and joke about it, for all of them have heard the legend of the werewolf. Later, at the base, automatic sirens begin to rail into the night, sensing someone or something has activated the perimeter fence. Now, while investigating, a security guard detects a large creature, similar to a wolf, standing on its hind legs. It gazes at the soldier for a moment and then flees, clearing a 3-meter fence with ease. A police dog was brought to the track of the beast, but upon arriving at the spot where the werewolf was seen, the canine cowers and howls, refusing to go any further. The candle at the shrine is relit, and the creature has been seen no more. Isn't that an interesting
story?
That's
wild right there.
Right? Yeah. And I got to looking on Phantoms and Monsters, and there's actually some people that wrote into Lawn about this of their own personal accounts. Now, check this one. This is pretty cool. It says, "I was a security policeman at Hahn from 1986 to 1990, and I spent a lot of time at Morbach. I, of course, heard all of the werewolf stories, too, but never seen anything that would indicate to me that a werewolf actually was there. I walked that area at night all the time, and sometimes by myself. It was always fun to scare new guys with the stories of the werewolf and then go make them do security checks of the perimeter on foot. One of our canines was this big black Bouvier with bloodshot eyes. And we would always send that dog and the dog handler to the backside of the area to meet the new guys with that dog. There were also some reports of some World War II ghosts that surrounded the area. But that's pretty cool. You know, he's basically saying he heard the stories, but he never really saw much. Mm-hmm. This is another one. He says, I was stationed at Hahn Air Force Base from 1987 to 1990, and I had the time of my life in the area. I think we had about 8 to 10 SPs at the munitions storage area at one time. And one night, about six of us, along with two canine dogs, decided to take a walk in the area without any weapons. We left them in the tractor trailer, and we had at Central Security Control. We first went to the pig pen that was in the storage area just to take a look at the pigs that were there, and the gate was secure. So we went on walking down the road. About 100 yards, we went off the roadway into the forest that was in the area. Now, walking along the dogs, they stopped suddenly, and we heard some noise in the brush. The dogs yelped, but they did not want to go any further. We heard something in the brush again, like we were being shadowed. Then came the type of howl you cannot duplicate, nor have ever heard. It seemed like it was just 20 or 30 yards closer to us. My hair, I remember, started to stand on my arms, and my body tingled all over. We all ran out of there as fast as we could. I cannot explain what I heard, and I've spent 20 years trying to justify or explain it. Here's another one. I was stationed at Hahn Air Force Base from 1986 to 1989. I was assigned as the flight chief for Charlie Flight Security. Now, we posted people at the MUNS site, commonly known as Moorbach, each night. I, too, heard the stories of the werewolf. Were they real? I don't know. But I do say this. A couple of my long-timers, who were there since about 1982 or 1983, swore to me that they saw the werewolf. They said that they observed a person, or what looked like a person, jump the fence. Now, this was a standard 7-foot chain-link fence with an 18-inch outrigger. They said when it jumped the fence, the thing took off on all fours. They also said that they brought a canine unit in, and when it did, when they took it to the place where they thought this supposed werewolf jumped the fence, the dogs became very nervous. Now, I walked the same area where this happened, and I have to say, at night, it was pretty scary. On a lighter note, it says the newbies who were assigned the area were always taken to the spot where the werewolf jumped the fence and then were told the story. And on one occasion, one of the pranksters decided to hide under some leaves. And when the new troop came by, the prankster reached out from under the leaves and grabbed the young guy by the leg. And they said screams were heard throughout the night and the sound of a round being chambered into an M16. Fortunately, another cop grabbed the rifle before it was used for its intended purpose. Says, needless to say, after that, this prank was never played again, at least not while I was there. But another guy wrote in, and this one's pretty cool. He's like, look, I was there from 1982 to 1984, and I and four others were sent to do some security watch one night there at the NATO ammo dump. And the five of us, with one pair of night vision goggles, from the side of a hill, saw something run to the fence and then jump right over it. And then whatever it was, person or animal, stooped down on all fours and ran off like a dog. And this guy saw this with night vision. Him and four others.
Yeah, see, that's not like what we were discussing. That doesn't sound like a villager, you know. That,
no.
That sounds more like a creature.
This sounds more modern. And this is like, you know, we're getting into the modern dogman story. So there are these sightings, even in other countries. It's pretty spooky.
All right, I got one here for you. We'll wrap up with this. We were talking about this dogman stuff. Now, this actually comes from a while back. I say a while. 1911 was when this happened. Now, Lon posted this, and this is what drew me into this whole thing, because it's a romantic idea to me for where it's at. I'm going to read this to you. It says, sir, I would like to pass along a true story told to me by my grandfather when I was a young man. The story involves my great-grandfather, whose name was James McNamara. He was a patrolman in the New York City Police Department. Now, this incident occurred in October of 1911 during the late evening hours. James was assigned to the theater district. in the area of Broadway and 42nd Street. Another patrolman, by the name of Dobbins, was two blocks south of Broadway near 40th Street. Theatergoers were walking about and enjoying the Great White Way when suddenly there were screams emanating from an alley just below James's position. Both patrolmen ran toward the ruckus, forcing their way through hundreds of fleeing pedestrians. As they reached the alleyway, a tall, hairy beast ran out onto Broadway and towards 40th Street. Neither patrolman could believe what they saw. An 8-foot-tall wolf with human-like arms and legs running with skill and speed down the middle of Broadway. Soon the beast was facing a New York City Packard squad car, so it changed direction and moving back towards McNamara and Dobbins. The beast was growling as it moved forward. The patrolman took positions by a newsstand, hiding and waiting for the horrible creature to move before them. Soon, the beast was at the entrance of another alleyway near 42nd Street. Both patrolmen pulled their service revolvers and took deadly aim. The beast quickly dropped to the gutter. Immediately, McNamara and Dobbins surrounded the body as other officers joined them. None of the public was allowed to come within 100 feet of the unknown canine. The body was quickly removed and taken to the mortuary. Both patrolmen were placed on their other assignments. The squad was told by their superiors that this was simply mistaken identity and that the deceased man was in a costume. Of course, that was not the truth. The press was later told that a large mad dog caused the disruption and that none of the public were injured. Now, a few months later, a brief article was published in a Louisiana newspaper called the St. Mary Banner from Franklin, Louisiana, and picked up by a few other media outlets. And it says, New York, no sign remained in the Broadway Theater District the next morning following the scenes that were enacted there one night when a maddened beast charged up and down, spreading terror and consternation, causing handsomely gowned women to faint and strong men to leave their cocktails untouched and flee for safety. That lion with the burning tail that broke loose during the Coney Island fire last spring was a tame affair in comparison with the Broadway monster. The beast is described in the police blotter as a large terrier, but it is evident that the police were anxious to minimize the seriousness of the panic. Hundreds of these witnesses will testify that the animal was at least 8 feet tall. Its foaming mouth and wicked fangs were too terrible for description. The beast was seen first at Broadway and 42nd Street. With a blood-curdling bow wow, it rushed up to a beautiful woman as her companion rushed to her assistance and fearlessly planted a kick in the monster's hindquarters. "Kia!" screamed the wild thing as it tore off down Broadway. At 40th Street, two boys, with the foolhardiness of youth, tried to seize the animal by the tail. The beast turned upon them and bayed horribly. On 39th Street, scattering pedestrians right and left raced the great dog, if indeed it was a dog. At the corner, it emitted a whine that was even more terrifying than its growl and turned back the way it had came. As the beast ran back, patrolmen McNamara and Dobbins drew their revolvers. Dobbins shot straight and true, and the monster keeled over in the gutter. The police have offered no further statements. Now, aside from that being some of the greatest writing from, because I want to say, yeah, see, you turn around and fired, see, man, not going to take me, copper, man. When you read that, it sounds like the vernacular from the early 1900s. Yeah. And I love how it is that it rushed up to a young woman, her fearless compadre, he runs up and he jumps and kicks it. You're like, come on, you know none of that happened.
Right.
People are screaming. There's no way that
I'm picturing like American Werewolf in London where it's running through the streets, snapping at people.
That's exactly what I'm
saying.
When
you're talking about the cocktail party, the Wolfman with Benicio del Toro. Remember when he transforms?
Yes. Yeah.
All those doctors are in there and he's running on the rooftops.
Yes.
You can just imagine this scene where this werewolf is running through and the streets you were describing, Broadway and 40th and stuff. I know where all that stuff is. I've been to Manhattan numerous times.
Yes.
So I'm picturing what that must have been
like. Well, here's the crazy thing.
I liked how the cops shoot this terrier-like dog and then it turns out that it's a man. And they're like, don't look over here. It was just a big mistake.
Just a dude.
It's a guy in a costume, but they rush him off into this mortuary.
Yeah. Just
man.
There was nothing ever
posted. What if all the stories of people lycanthropes, people being an animal, being shot, turning back into a man. The Skinwalker stories where a wolf is shot and it turns out to be an old woman.
Mm-hmm.
What if that stuff's real, man?
Well, what made me think of this is it's got a dog head but human body, like we discussed from the Greek stories coming down from the mountains. What is going on here? Because what you're talking about, the story that you've discussed, those are wolves. Those are like upright canids.
Mm-hmm.
The ones I discussed are like a half-breed. They talk, what could... There's too much. Like we always say, folks, make up your own mind. But if you look at this and you look at the reports through history and you look at the reports we get now of what we see now, is it romanticized? I think you could tell by the story I just read that there's a lot of romanticizing that goes in these stories, each and every one. Anytime you hear anything along these, there's a lot of romantic ideals behind it. Yes. And that's what makes a story a great story. You know, you can play the music, you can picture the old movies of King Kong and the way people are dressed and the running. Yeah, that sounds great and all. But is there something there? I like to think there is. There's something there that we are, maybe we're missing for the big part, but there's little pieces that we have to pick up. Bread trails, and or breadcrumb trails, I'm sorry. And if you think of that, that's kind of what this is... You know, we have all these Greek stuff. We have all this stuff from Africa, from India. The stories that you're talking about of these guys that, were they really serial killers and just madmen? Or were they, maybe there was something to it. Maybe this was the same, like a serial killer or a mad, you know what I'm saying? Maybe there was more to it than that. I don't know, but there's definitely something there. Maybe it is a tulpa like we've discussed and like you brought up. There's something to it, though. There's something there that we can't quite, it's slippery. It's like you're trying to hang on to it. It's just real slippery. We can't get our hands on it just yet. But I think we're getting close. Maybe we're I hope so. I like to believe that maybe we're going to get some answers one day. Maybe we're not. Maybe we're just never going to get to that level.
Right. Pretty cool, man. Well, let's take a break, folks. Stick with us. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Very interesting stories. I love the stories of dogmen, even the old ones. I think they're pretty cool. All right, real quick, before we end the show, one of my favorite interviews we ever did was with Mr. Robert Schock when he had him on about his book, Lost Civilization. And Robert Schock has got this new thing coming out. Now, if you're not familiar with Robert Schock, he's an anthropologist and a geologist from George Washington University. Also, he has a degree from Yale. I mean, this guy knows his business. And he was the guy that first discovered, well, actually, John Anthony West told him about it, and then he later established a theory about the water erosion on the Sphinx, right? Well, he's got this new thing that he's created called Oracle, which is the Organization for the Research of Ancient Cultures. Now, he talks about how the orthodox view of the rise of civilization is wrong, and for many years, a number of alternative historians have put forward the new view that there is enough evidence to suggest that an advanced civilization existed in prehistory, but through some kind of cataclysm, it disappeared within the mists of time. Now, this is a very similar thread to what Graham Hancock writes about, and this is also the same thread that we're always talking about. I believe that there was an ancient civilization, that time is forgot, that we just don't recognize, and the recent discovery of, like, Göbekli Tepe, Nan Madal, even perhaps the Bosnian pyramids, like we were talking about on Thursday, these are bringing to light the fact, and I think it's undeniable at this point, that there was an ancient civilization here that somehow has been erased through time. Well, Robert Schock, he's formed this new organization for the research of ancient cultures, and it's a nonprofit designed and devoted to the investigation and discussion of these forbidden history ideas. Give this a listen.
Civilization, how far back in time does it go? Did it arise in Mesopotamia around 3500 BC? Or, as Plato and legend suggest, did a high civilization, perhaps global, exist on Earth in our prehistory? I'm Robert Schock. Many of you know me from my research of ancient sites around the world, and in particular, my work on the Great Sphinx of Egypt. In the early 1990s, I demonstrated that the Great Sphinx shows geological evidence of water erosion. Water weathering to this degree is impossible if the traditional dating of the monument, circa 2500 BC, is accurate, for the Sphinx sits on the edge of the Sahara Desert, a hyper-arid region for the last 5,000 years, all of recorded history. As if pushing back the age of civilization by several thousand years was not enough, an archaeological site in southeastern Turkey, Göbekli Tepe, is leaving traditional historians and archaeologists dumbfounded. It dates back a staggering 12,000 years and shows evidence of sophistication that defies orthodox thinking. Megalithic pillars with anthropomorphic features, relief carvings of breathtaking beauty and craftsmanship, stone circles meticulously excavated by the German Archaeological Institute. The dating spans the end of the last ice age. Furthermore, the site was intentionally buried, not simply abandoned and left to time. Göbekli Tepe was preserved by survivors of a cataclysm, as the site itself demonstrates. In my book, Forgotten Civilization, I concluded our sun was a major culprit in the ancient demise. But I'm not here to speak about what caused the end of our last ice age or what decimated the high civilizations of the time. What I'm here to do now is introduce you to an organization I've co-founded with friends and colleagues to study this compelling subject. The mission of the Organization for the Research of Ancient Cultures, or ORACULE as we call it, is to pursue this important research. Humanity deserves to know more about those who came before us, about civilizations and cultures of the remote past. We cannot do it alone. We need your help. And we know that many of you are as passionate about the work as we are. So we ask for your support. Right now, we need startup contributions. As we progress, we'll need your support for field projects, educational outreach programs, conferences, and much more. ORACULE is a nonprofit 501c3, so anything you give is tax deductible. Every dollar is greatly appreciated. On behalf of my colleagues and friends, I thank you for your time and support.
That's pretty cool, man. So if you'd like to help kickstart ORACULE with a contribution of your own, and I suggest you do it, you can do so via oracleonline.org. I will put the show notes, the links to it in the show notes as well. I'm going to donate to it because I like this moving forward, trying to acknowledge that we don't know as much about the past. And I do think there was a great civilization and that it's happened. The rise and fall of humans has probably happened numerous times throughout the eons of time. Where we are today could be the 8th or 9th or 10th time that we've risen to this level. And each time it rises, new things are created.
Yeah.
And then if something happens, an asteroid or comet or coronal mass ejection or something happens, we're knocked down again. And then a very small pocket of humans has to start over. And when they start over, new things are designed. And then another outbreak or something knocks us back down. I think it's just going to keep happening. So I support anybody like Robert Schock, like Graham Hancock, like Randall Carlson, all these guys, Robert Bivol, all these guys that research and really look into the history of a time far beyond what, you know, modern day historians and anthropologists and people tell us. Very cool. Cam?
Yes.
What do you got planned for the week, brother?
I'm just working away, enjoying the show, and that's pretty much it, man. I don't have anything set aside too crazy. The weather's nice, so I'm just going to have a little fun, do a little more mowing. I think I'm going to build some stuff around the house. I really feel the need for some carpentry. I need to build something, so I don't know what it's going to be just yet, but I need to build something.
Then what was it you were mentioning to me earlier about a listener that's going to be sending something?
A good friend of ours, friend of the show, Dustin Ray. Now, folks, if those of you that love to go to the gym, now, look, I know we don't all love it. Some of us do. Some of us don't. I don't love the gym, but I go because I have to. But if you love some good gym clothes, Dustin has started a company. This is a pretty cool thing. He's a professional wrestler. And I don't mean like Greco-Roman. I mean like a wrestler, like a sports entertainment, smack him with chairs and stuff. This is what Dustin does. But he started a clothing company, folks, called American Rival. Now, if you get on Facebook, look up American Rival or go to American Rivals with an S, AmericanRivals.com. He sells some great T-shirts. So if you want to support another friend of the show, you want to help him out or whatnot, check him out. Go to Facebook. You can probably get on Twitter. He's got a YouTube channel. But go to AmericanRivals.com. Order you a T-shirt. He's got some really stuff. Some of it is hilarious, the things that are on here. He's got one that's like Straight Out of Protein, which from Straight Out of Compton. It makes me laugh every time I see it. So, all right, folks. That's pretty much all we got. We've given it. We're going to have to go, I don't know, Kyle needs to go mow or something, I'm sure. He's got weed eating to do or whatnot. And I'm sure the boys need to play a little baseball. So I guess we better get out of here.
Yeah, it's about time. Don't forget, folks, if you want more Expanded Perspectives, you can always go to the website, expandedperspectives.com. Click on the Elite tab. Become an Elite member. It's only $5 a month or $55 a year, and you'll get an extra episode every single Thursday, as well as access to the entire back catalog. Sign up now. If you want to share a story with Expanded Perspectives, you can send those stories to expandedperspectives@yahoo.com or go to the website, click on the contact page, and you can send us your story or sighting. Or if you prefer to call the show, you can call us at 817-945-3828, and we'd love to hear what you think about it. Yes, Cam.
One more thing, too. Now we're going to have a surprise for the next Monday show. We're going to have somebody in studio with us, folks. Get ready. The one and the only, the mouth of the South, Mr. Micah Hanks, is going to be in here with us. And if we can get it worked out, we're going to have Red Pill Junkie in here. We're going to try to get several folks in here coming up. So in the next week or so, we're going to be shaking and baking with some pretty wild stuff. So we're going to bring back all kinds of things. But yeah, we're going to have a few. Maybe Mr. Joshua Cutchin will join us. We might get Nick to come back over. I don't know. But we're going to try to have some parties. So that is coming up real soon.
That is pretty cool. For all you Elite members, we'll be speaking to you on Thursday. For everybody else, stay out of trouble. We'll talk to you next Monday. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace.
luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.